Hi, and welcome to Happiness Through Hardship, the podcast, where we share positive stories and suggestions about finding hope, resources, and connections to help us all get through hard times. I'm Karen Sullivan, a mom, an author, and a stage 4 cancer patient who's always looking around me for inspiration. I believe in surrounding myself with people and experiences that make me smile. And that's what I'm hoping to do for you today. So grab your favorite drink, get cozy, and let's get started. I am so excited to introduce you to Dr. Sarah Silverman, or should I say, Dr. Sarah Sleep, a psychologist with training at the Stanford Sleep Medicine Center, striving to help others sleep better without the help of medication. Through practices such as sleep therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and circadian rhythm optimization, Dr. Sarah is able to help anyone struggling with their nightly routines to establish healthier sleep habits and hopefully renew their sleep confidence. Welcome, Sarah. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. And that was such a lovely introduction. Thank you so much for that.
Well, you're welcome. As I said to her beforehand, and I will say to all the listeners, I mean, raise your hand if you've ever had any sleep issues or sleep challenges, whether it's like me, I've got stage 4 cancer, I'm on different medications, and sometimes I just have sleep problems. Or if you're just, when we had babies, right, going through pregnancy, you could have sleep issues. Whether you're going through a rough time in life, a breakup, bad dreams, I mean, throw in the ringer, or maybe even you're so excited because you're going on vacation and you just can't sleep. I mean, I'm just throwing out a few there. I think that this topic is so important because no matter where we're coming from, it is something that could end up being an issue in our lives, having challenges with sleep. So Sarah, I want to just say again how grateful that I am to have you here. And I would like to speak on behalf of the listeners. I really do believe that this is a topic they're coming here and they're excited to hear from you. So I think I want to level set first, and I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about what healthy sleep looks like, because I know I spent years just getting a few hours of sleep. In fact, and I know I've told this story before on some podcast, it might have even been one that we touched upon this topic earlier, several years ago, where I would brag to the big boss at the company I worked at, telling him that, like, he's like, how are you doing it all, Karen? You just had a baby. And I was put on a few new projects. And I looked at him and I said, Justin, I'm sleeping 3 hours. And you know what? I'm doing great. And I laugh now because clearly I was burning the candle at both ends. But I want to say, I think that a lot of people are in whatever grind that they're in, or even if it's not a grind, they follow their schedule and they don't really realize how to have healthy sleep. So we start there.
I love this question because I think there's so much emphasis these days on getting enough sleep, which is very important. But healthy sleep is comprised of both sleep quality and sleep quantity. So this is really going to look unique based on the individual because we all have different sleep needs. And sleep need, as in the number of hours that your body actually needs in order to feel well rested and function at its best during the day. So there's a really wide range of sleep need across the lifespan. And of course, that can change as we get older. But for most adults, usually is anywhere between 6 to 10 hours. I know there's so much focus on 7 to 9 hours for adults, that magic number being 8. And sure, a lot of people do fall into that average range, but there's a very wide range. So a low and a high range. And so, you know, less people are going to fall on the smaller and longer end, but they could still be considered a normal amount of sleep need based on the individual. And so sleep quantity is important, but also the quality piece. So quality meaning, is your sleep feeling restorative upon waking? Are you feeling well rested when you wake up in the morning? And are you experiencing, for the most part, pretty consistent sleep? So meaning, are you able to fall asleep within 20, 30 minutes, give or take? And if you are waking up during the night, which we can also talk a little bit more about this too, waking up is a very normal part of the process of sleep. So if you're waking up and you're awake for up to 20, 30 minutes or so, that also is considered a normal or healthy amount of time to be awake at night. So to summarize that and kind of put it into a very simplified version of what healthy sleep may look like, we in the sleep community like to call it the 30-30 minute rule of thumb. So if you're falling asleep less than 30 minutes or so and then awake during the night for up to 30 minutes or so, that's still considered a normal or healthy amount of time to be awake. And that truly is, I would say, ideal as far as having healthy sleep. And then again, the number of hours of sleep that someone may need is going to look different based on their body's needs for wherever they're at in their season of life. And that can certainly change over time as well. And then, of course, medical conditions and stress levels play a role in that number too.
Can you talk a moment about teenagers and sleep? Because I know a lot of the listeners have kids and, you know, our kids are fighting back at us. They don't need enough sleep, or they're maybe trying to tell us they're sleeping and we know they might be doing other things where they're not getting as much sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. So teenagers, there's also a very wide range of sleep need amongst teens. Certainly as kids and teens are growing, they are going to need a little bit more sleep in general. So I'd say usually up to 12 to 14 hours might be appropriate for some teens. What's also interesting for a lot of teenagers is a shift in the timing of their sleep schedule. So it's actually very common for teenagers to be more of a night owl. And that is actually because of the normal shift that happens during puberty. And what ends up happening from a sleep perspective is it shifts the timing of sleep onset. So for a lot of teens, they actually may not feel sleepy until much later into the night, usually after 1, 2, maybe 3 in the morning. And then, of course, they're waking up very early for school. So that cuts off their total sleep time. And they're actually losing quite a bit of sleep because of this shift in their timing. So teenagers may have this delayed sleep schedule, and then most people will grow out of it once they, you know, become young adults and maybe enter the workforce. But there are quite a few people who end up staying in that later sleep schedule as well. So it very much depends on the individual. But in general, teenagers are going to need more sleep as they're developing, and then there may actually be this delayed shift in the timing of their sleep schedule, which is very normal and to be expected.
So I just have to ask here, 12 to 14 hours is, I mean, I want to say, I don't know how that's realistic. Back on the shift, because I mean, if 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, these kids need to get up at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, almost at the latest. As a teenager, if they're going to bed, even at 9:30, that seems early. If they're going to bed at 10:30 and they're waking up at 7:30, mm-hmm. right? Like that, you know, as an adult, 9 hours sleep seems good. Is there harm to their body, or is that just some kids need 12 to 14, some kids need a lot less.
Yeah. So some kids will need that 12 to 14 hours. So they may need a little bit more sleep in general. Some kids may not need as much. You know, there may be some who only need, say, 7 or 8 hours. But I think what ends up happening for a lot of teens, they end up losing quite a bit of sleep during the week as a result of having to get up for school. And this is something that the sleep community has known for decades. We've had research to support this idea that most kids and teens are not actually getting enough sleep because of their school timing. And more recently, there are some states who have caught on to this and are actually trying to change this, California being the first state to actually shift high school time, depending on your county, but some schools even an hour later, which can make such a huge difference for teens who need that extra sleep, especially because of how we cycle through our stages in the night. usually the early morning hours could actually be when we're getting some REM or dream sleep. And that's when we're consolidating memories and things that we learn. And that's really important for growing brains. So some states have caught on to that and are starting to slowly shift school timing.
I have heard that. Yes.
Which is fantastic. I think it's a step in the right direction, but I really hope that all states adopt that, because especially for high schoolers, which usually have the earliest start time for most teens, they're really feeling the wrath of not getting enough sleep throughout the week. So I'd say the biggest thing that most teens will notice are short-term effects of sleep deprivation, which usually looks like feeling really tired or fatigued during the day, maybe even being sleepy, as in falling asleep during class, maybe even just feeling like they're having a hard time staying awake during the day. That's usually a telltale sign that they're not getting enough sleep during the night. And then, of course, that can impact their performance on tests and things. And, you know, it certainly can affect how they function at their best during the school day.
Can we talk a little bit about, I mean, that all makes sense to me. And I had a moment where I wanted to jump in there and ask, mm-hmm. Well, how do we know how much sleep our actual body needs? I think you answered that when you said, do you wake up and you feel restored? Right? I gotta believe that there's tests out there, some gimmicks, some not, to know, you know, if your body really is in good, is good sleep. I remember, you know, the watches and things could tell us how many and maybe even the type of sleep. I don't know how they do that. Is there anything that you would suggest out there if somebody is questioning, am I getting good sleep, that they could try?
It's a fantastic question. And certainly wearables like the Fitbit and Apple Watch and the Oura Ring are great ways to track trends and patterns over time. They aren't the best as far as sleep staging goes. They still have a little bit of ways to go as far as being as sophisticated as an in-lab sleep study, but they are really good at predicting your average total sleep time. So that would be a good way to kind of check in and see how many hours you're getting on a regular basis. I'd say really the best way is to kind of check in with how you're feeling during the day. And what we all experience upon waking, I might add, is this period of grogginess called sleep inertia, where our brain is kind of waking up, moving from sleep into wakefulness. So it is actually normal to feel a little bit groggy upon waking, but usually that period of sleep inertia dissipates on its own within 15, 20 minutes for most people. So you may not feel well rested right upon waking, because you might still be in that transition state. So I usually recommend checking in about an hour after you've been up. And at that point, if you're feeling alert, especially mentally alert for the day, you're probably getting enough sleep, especially if you're able to sustain that level of alertness throughout the day. And of course, there's some ebbs and flow of our overall alertness and fatigue levels during the day, which are very normal. But generally, if you're able to stay awake during the day, you're not dozing off at your desk, you're not taking very long naps on a regular basis, you're more than likely getting enough sleep. And then as far as the quality piece goes, you want to feel like you're well rested and check in, I would say, about an hour after you've been up. That's really kind of the best place to start.
Now that is huge and new news to me, because I can't tell you how many times I've said, oh, my husband is not a morning person. And now my son is not a morning person. They are crabby. Can I say that? They're crabby when they wake up in the morning. They don't want to get out of bed, especially if they have to go to an alarm. And I have just assumed, whereas I could, like, I want to stay in bed and be all cuddly and warm, but I could just jump out and feel pretty good. And they take maybe a half an hour, maybe an hour. So it's the sleep inertia could be the thing for them.
Yes, very much so. And I tend to see sleep inertia being prolonged in individuals who are night owls. Especially for those who, you know, will say, I am not a morning person, and I am part of that club too. For night owls, it's a lot more common to have a period of prolonged sleep inertia in the morning. So sometimes it could be 30 minutes. Sometimes it can be an hour. Sometimes it can be a couple hours, you know, especially for some kids who maybe are waking up very early for school. They might not actually feel alert until a couple hours later as their brain fully transitions into being awake. So it may take some time for some individuals to come out of that prolonged state of sleep inertia.
Now, I want to ask you what now to me seems like a silly question, because I feel like it's just I should have said, duh, Karen, of course I need more sleep. But going back to the person that I told you about in my 20s, early 30s, where I thought I was a champion because I didn't need much sleep because I needed more time, I didn't realize that that was hard on my body. I didn't realize the whole the truth of that your body needs sleep so it can regenerate its cells. For those of you that are out there, humor me, you might already know this, which, like I said, I didn't. But can you just take a minute and explain all the benefits of having healthy sleep? Because I literally thought sleep was one of the easiest things I could give up, because there were so many other things I wanted to do. I did not value it at all. And I almost even rolled my eyes at my husband for being so proud that he was a great sleeper and that he would sleep so long, because my excuse would be like, just get up. We got things to do.
Yeah. Yeah. This is so common. And it's one of those things where, you know, to answer your question, I could say sleep affects every area of our health and overall wellness. So starting with physical health, you know, to me, sleep is the foundation of physical health. When you are getting enough sleep, but also good quality sleep, that really helps your body do all of its major functions in the way that it's intended. And it's more than just kind of the physical aspect too, it also feeds into cognitive health or mental health, mental clarity, the emotional health side of sleep too. I mean, I think we could all agree that after a not so great night of sleep, we may feel a little bit more cranky or irritable. So that also plays a major role. My goodness, I could also say having good, healthy sleep also impacts how your body digests food, or how your body actually craves certain foods or may eat more calories, depending on how many hours of sleep that you get. We're now more recently in the sleep research world really making the connection between sleep and eating and how our quality of sleep can change our microbiome and our gut health and things of that nature too. So physical health, cognitive health, emotional, mental health, I would say also just affects motivation to want to work out during the day or exercise or even spend time with family and be present for social connections. I mean, the list goes on. I mean, you can really think about sleep as the foundation for all aspects of how we function during the day.
And now I understand. And the last 10 years, I mean, since my stage 4 diagnosis, when I really looked at my lifestyle and changed it tremendously, that was a huge difference, because I now value sleep. And I will tell you, anybody who's listening out there, I will shout from the mountaintops that those first few months when I was diagnosed with stage 4, and mind you, like, this is my hardship, and wherever you're coming through in life, like, it doesn't have to be of this magnitude. It can be from any stressor in your life. Like, that takes a toll, period, whatever it might be. And when I noticed myself getting a lot of sleep, you know, and then we'll say eating well too and being active, I had so much different and better energy. I felt better in my own skin. I spent a lot of years, and we can laugh about the amount of Diet Dr. Pepper I drank, or I'd call it a pretty coffee that had lots of sugar in it. Not whipped cream. For some reason, I would say, hold on, the whipped cream. But I fueled myself on, you know, food that didn't nourish my body, but the caffeine, because I was tired, or to your point, like, I was a little fuzzy and I just felt like I needed to eat. And so I just ate what was there. And I think, listen, I can't speak for everyone saying you've made those mistakes, but I think that they're common because we're just trying to put one foot in front of the other. And the interesting thing is as I, you know, I'm clearly not as ingrained in the sleep community as you are, but as I was looking at the research about wellness, sleep was kind of this bottom line that you absolutely need. But I know that there are a lot of reasons why people may, you know, not have great sleep. So can you talk a little bit about some of the, like, the root causes of difficulties and how we can, I don't want to use the word attack them, like how we can work with it to try and find better sleep?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And oh, there are so many reasons for not having great sleep or having poor quality sleep. But I'd say one of the biggest areas, and it's an umbrella term, you know, medical conditions. And we'll take cancer as an example, because it's something that I actually tend to see a lot in my practice, because having insomnia after receiving a cancer diagnosis is incredibly common. And cancer can actually affect the area of the brain that controls our sleep-wake cycle. So a lot of folks with cancer will notice a shift in their sleep pattern. So things may shift a little bit. They may also notice a reduced total sleep time, so may not actually need as much sleep as a result as well. And you can take a number of other medical conditions, especially, you know, things like hypothyroidism or any type of chronic pain, fibromyalgia, just about, I would say every medical condition, especially if it's a chronic condition, is going to have some impact on sleep and is going to potentially change the sleep timing. So a lot of people will notice that maybe their sleep schedule becomes a little bit more variable or irregular, and it can also change the number of hours that someone may need. So a lot of folks will experience a shortened sleep time, but some folks may experience the opposite, where they sleep a lot more than they might normally sleep as well. One of the really big reasons or underlying reasons for developing, say, insomnia, and we can definitely dive into insomnia as well, but it's incredibly common. I'd say it's usually stress-related, especially chronic stress, especially if there is any levels of anxiety or depression, even a history of trauma. So many mental health reasons for why sleep also can become disrupted or fragmented. So both, I would say, mental health and physical health conditions, especially if they're chronic, are usually some of the underlying root causes or reasons for why someone may develop poor sleep or notice some changes in their sleep. And what I tend to find is sleep gets disrupted for folks once they maybe have a chronic condition, and then they start to worry about why they're not sleeping. And then as soon as that worry kicks in, it becomes a vicious cycle. And oftentimes too, there are some behaviors or habits that people are doing that they believe may help improve their sleep, but may actually be inadvertently keeping them stuck in this vicious cycle. And so incredibly nuanced, depending on how sleep changes from person to person. But usually as we get older, and especially in women, there are a number of hormone changes as well that can disrupt sleep too. And then you add in any medical conditions, you add in stress levels, you add in, you know, family stuff and other responsibilities, and it becomes this hodgepodge of all these different issues that impact your sleep quality.
Oh, and it's like, and just hearing all this, like, stresses us out, because, you know, I've been there before where I'm even a little bit tired and I get in bed and then I can't sleep. And then I'm stressing about how I need, you know, there's 3 hours left to sleep. There's 5 hours left to sleep, whatever the number might be. So I could see where that would be very common. So what do we do? I know that you're this expert in non-medical therapies, or should I say non-medicinal therapies. Is that right?
Yeah.
That take a non-medicated approach.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Can you talk about that? Because I want the listeners, they probably came here because they're like, oh, I'm curious to learn. I'm having some sleep issues, or I know somebody who has sleep issues. What can people do?
Yes, I love this question. Because as you may know very well, our conventional doctors are very much trained in the medication side of things and are very quick to prescribe sleep medication or just medication to help with sleep. And while I'm not opposed to medication, I do think that they are a tool. Like many things in life, they can be incredibly helpful on a short-term basis. They're usually prescribed without an exit strategy, and also they're prescribed without also addressing the underlying root causes for why someone is struggling to sleep in the first place. So of course, depending on the individual, what to do or how to improve sleep is going to look a little bit different, but I'd say some of the practices are foundational for everybody. And I always tell my clients, keep it simple. The more simple and consistent you can keep things, the better your body is going to respond. And I think what's really difficult is we live in a world where, you know, we have so much information about sleep these days, and there's, you know, many different ways that you can look up sleep hygiene or healthy sleep habits and sleep advice. And while all of that is important, usually if someone is experiencing a primary sleep problem, like insomnia, for example, sleep hygiene or that general sleep advice probably isn't going to be enough, or really it isn't going to cut it. And that is because sleep hygiene behaviors are really great to maintain healthy sleep. And so we can certainly dive into those a little bit, but as far as from my perspective.
Well, I'm curious what you're saying when you say sleep hygiene. It's the, is it the, I mean, you tell me, just so we know that we're all on the same page here. I'm thinking like, you know, no TV before bed.
Exactly. Right?
The things that you read in the magazines, but what are those?
Yeah. So sleep hygiene behaviors are things like don't eat too close to bed. You want to have, you know, about a 3-hour buffer zone from your last meal and your bedtime. Don't work out too close to bed. You don't want to, you know, do a strenuous workout right before you're jumping into bed. So you always want a buffer zone of about 3 hours or so. Also things like really being mindful of your screen time before bed, you know, ideally turning off screens or reducing your screen use before bed, making sure that you're not consuming loads of caffeine late into the day in the afternoon, healthy practices in terms of what you're doing during the day and also how close those kind of lifestyle behaviors are to your bedtime. All very important. But usually when someone is having lots of sleep issues, they're probably trying those things, or maybe have already tried those things and they're still not seeing any improvement in their sleep. And so sleep hygiene, I think about, are all those healthy sleep behaviors. And whenever you look up, you know, how to sleep better, usually Google will show you the sleep hygiene tips. So great to keep in mind and to keep into practice, but they're usually not enough to overcome chronic sleep issues like insomnia, for example.
Okay, so let's jump in there. What do you suggest for people that are dealing with chronic sleep issues?
So my training is in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and it's a very specialized training when dealing with more chronic sleep issues, and insomnia being a primary sleep disorder. So CBT for insomnia is very much a non-medication approach for helping people learn how to sleep naturally and without medication. Although a lot of folks that I work with are on sleep medication, and then the goal is to help them come off eventually in a very slow and strategic way, but very safe and cautiously as well. So CBT for insomnia is actually considered the first line approach for chronic insomnia in adults. And I always like to make this distinction very clear from sleep hygiene, because a lot of people may look it up and they'll say, oh, that's kind of the same thing. But there's actually very specific techniques that are under the umbrella of CBTI that have been shown to be even more effective than just sleep hygiene. In fact, in a lot of the research, sleep hygiene is usually the control and the CBTI is, you know, the treatment. And we see vast improvement in people who actually engage in CBTI versus just the sleep hygiene group. So sleep hygiene is more so, you know, think about it like dental hygiene. It's going to your hygienist every 6 months or so to help you continue to maintain good oral health. Same kind of idea with sleep hygiene. It helps to maintain good, healthy sleep if you already have it. But if you, you know, have a cavity or you need a root canal, you have to see the dentist. So just like insomnia is more of like that cavity or root canal, it's an actual problem, have to see a specialist. And so CBTI, while it encompasses sleep hygiene, there are several other components or techniques that are a lot more effective than just sleep hygiene alone.
So then do they come to a practitioner like yourself, your office, and you do these techniques with them there and then they bring it home with them?
Yeah, for the most part, it's very much having a conversation about what is going to be more of a long-term solution. So learning specific skills that are going to help someone be able to manage their sleep disruption for years to come and really, you know, the rest of their lives. So yes, you know, in my practice, I see folks virtually. So we, you know, meet and we discuss the techniques and I teach folks the skills. And then in between visits, the idea is to practice those techniques and implement them and then give their body a chance to adjust. And then every time we meet, we kind of tweak the strategies or fine tune their habits and go from there. So it very much is behavioral, but there's also that cognitive piece too, which is about changing mindset.
So you're a psychologist, so changing mindset around whatever it might be, dealing with sleep. What might be, just because I'm trying to picture it, if you've got a patient that's working with you, what might one of the strategies that you use be with CBTI? Yeah.
Happy to dive into this. It's interesting because nowadays, actually, some of the CBTI techniques have been grouped into sleep hygiene. And I'll share one with you in particular because I do see this a lot online, but it's actually one of the techniques within CBTI and it's called stimulus control. That's the official term for it. But it's essentially the practice of keeping your bed as just a place for sleep. So you may have seen something along the lines of making sure that you keep your bed just for sleep. And whenever you're doing something that's considered a wakeful activity, like reading a book, watching TV, you ideally want to be doing that in another room. Because what ends up happening for a lot of folks, if you're lying in bed awake and you're doing something for a prolonged period of time when you're not actually sleeping, over time, what can happen is your brain can associate that wakefulness with being in your bed and your bedroom. So the best way that we have found to help folks be able to really ensure that they can improve their sleep quality is by actually just physically getting up and out of bed whenever they're not sleeping, so that when they do get into bed, that quality of sleep is much higher. And of course, it does take some time for the brain to relearn and make some new connections with being in the bed in the bedroom. But just as an example, you know, because I tend to see folks who have a lot more severe cases of insomnia, sometimes even just walking into the bedroom, someone sees their bed, their brain automatically thinks bed is stressful. You know, sleep is a stressful experience for me. And so it is very much about retraining the brain to create a new connection with the bed in the bedroom. And that does take time, but it's very much a behavioral practice in the case of this technique to remove yourself from your bed in your bedroom whenever you're not sleeping.
That's interesting because, yeah, I have heard that before. And there I am at 3 o'clock in the morning not being able to sleep. And I'm like, oh, I don't really want to get out of bed though. But it makes sense. What you're saying is that my at that point, I've probably stirred enough in my sleep and just to get up to maybe I'll go have tea. And then when I come back, I think the hope would be that my brain's like, all right, that's a restful place. But that makes sense.
Yeah. And no one wants to get up in the middle of the night. So it's not fun, especially in the beginning. But to that, I say you want to plan something that you would actually look forward to doing in the middle of the night. So it gets to be actually an enjoyable time for you, depending on how long you are awake during the night. So it's more so kind of embracing a little bit of time awake because it's normal to have some time awake during the night. But you also want that time to be very enjoyable and pleasant for you. So yeah, grabbing a cup of tea, maybe reading a book for a little bit, sometimes even, you know, I'll recommend like adult coloring books or playing a crossword puzzle or a word search or actually putting together like a jigsaw puzzle, something like that that's kind of lighthearted that you don't have to focus on too much, but that's also enjoyable to pass the time. And then once you feel sleepy again, and sleepy as in you can, you know, fall back asleep within 20 minutes, give or take, then you get back into bed. And so over time, your brain starts to learn, okay, when we're awake, we're in another room doing something enjoyable. And then when we're ready for sleep, we're back in bed. And then hopefully sleep becomes more of that peaceful recovery time as your brain learns that new connection.
Well, yes. I mean, that is the goal, right? And I think at this point now, I'm so grateful that there is so much content out there about the importance of sleep. Or, in, you know, as you said, having clean, I guess when we use the word hygiene, clean sleep hygiene, and including some of the factors that you mentioned before. Is there anything else that you could throw out there for those of us? Is it, you know, I'm talking about little things like, do we take a shower before bed or do we not? Are there things that people don't realize that are easy to do that could help tweak their hygiene and maybe make them a little more tired?
I love this question. There are absolutely some tweaks. And one of the best places to start is actually wake up time. And I say that because we don't have much control over when we fall asleep, but we do have a little bit more control over when we wake up, because we can potentially set an alarm to wake up, or maybe we have to be up for responsibilities like school and work. But keeping a consistent rise time, ideally 7 days a week, actually helps prepare your brain to get sleepy around the same time each night. And so the more consistent you can keep that wake up time, the better. And that's truly the best place to start. I'd also say getting natural light is huge for helping us feel sleepy each night. In fact, when we get our natural light in the morning, it communicates to our brain what time we should be getting sleep each night. So pairing that consistent wake-up time with getting some natural sunlight in the morning, top two best techniques that I always recommend to folks. And they're small tweaks to make, but sometimes even just keeping that consistent wake-up time can be a little bit challenging for some folks. Because I know weekends, especially, are non-work days. Maybe you want to try to sleep in, but that ends up throwing things off a little bit. So it's actually best to kind of keep that as consistent as possible. And then on the other side, you know, before bed, I think, as you mentioned, taking a bath or a warm shower is definitely something that may be beneficial for some folks. What we know based on research is about 90 minutes before our bedtime is kind of the optimal time to take a warm bath or shower, because it allows our core body temperature to drop a couple degrees to promote sleep onset. And so that, you know, may look a little bit different based on the individual, but I think that's kind of a sweet spot. So that can certainly be a cue for your brain that if you do end up doing that on a regular basis, your brain will start to associate that warm bath or shower with, okay, it's almost time for bed, let's start winding down. And so that can be a really great practice. I would also recommend just carving out 20-30 minutes, because I know we all are very busy and sometimes it's hard to think about having this amazing hour to wind down routine. So 20 minutes if you can, I mean, really however much time that you have, but doing something that's screen-free, if possible, about 20-30 minutes before bed, doing something that's going to be less mentally stimulating for your brain is such a great way to communicate that it's almost time for sleep. And along those lines too, another quick way to help communicate that it's time for sleep is to block blue light. And I know there's so much information about artificial blue light these days too. It depends on the individual as far as how stimulating the light can be, but a quick way to troubleshoot that is if you've seen those blue light blocking glasses, which they're not all created equal, but I often recommend investing in a pair with red lenses. Red lenses are going to offer the most blue light blocking protection, and that's an easy way.
Is there a brand you like?
I do. And actually, I can send them to you as well for the show notes.
I'll put them in. Yes, absolutely. They'll be in the show notes. So if you're driving right now and you don't have a pen or pencil, we'll make sure to go back there and I'll put links in.
Yes. I have a couple of brands I like. Filter Optics is one and True Dark is another. But really, we want that condensed lighting feel because that's what our brains actually need before bed. So you think about, you know, back in our ancestor days when we're sitting by the fire, that candescent lighting really communicated to the brain that it was nighttime and it was almost time for sleep. So we want to mimic that if we can in our environment, which is really hard because we all have bright overhead lights and reading screens. So it's a little bit easier for most folks to grab a pair of red light blockers, put them on, you know, ideally an hour or two before bed if possible. And then you can kind of go about your night and your wind down routine and block some of that blue light, which may impact sleep quality.
Well, thank you. That you've so many great ideas and you're full of knowledge. Clearly, this is a passion of yours too, because not just like your schooling, your certification, but the way that you talk so eloquently, and I'll throw different questions from left field and you just want to jump in and talk more about it. This conversation could go on for hours and hours, right? Like maybe we'll do a part two sometime.
Oh, I would
and
love that.
That would be great. And so if you're listening right now and you want more, definitely reach out. You can come to me at Pretty Wellness and reach out via Instagram. That's probably where I communicate the most. Or you can, you're at Dr. Sarah Sleep on Instagram as well. You could reach out if you have simple questions for her. Now, Dr. Sarah, if people want to find you, there's Instagram. Where else can they find you?
Yes, I am at Dr. Sarah Sleep on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook. So I'm pretty much
so they'll find you.
Yeah, so whichever you prefer, you can get in contact. But I'm the most active on Instagram, so that usually is the best place to contact me. And I'm always happy to be a resource to folks because there's not many of us, not many insomnia specialists or holistic sleep specialists to go around. So I'm always happy to connect folks if they are looking for someone that's more local and they're trying to find a practitioner.
Well, thank you. I love talking about this topic. And I think it's because, like I said, it was just an area that I was so wrong about. Mm-hmm. And it has changed my life significantly. And I'm not going to say it was simple, because to change any habit, is it really that simple? But it wasn't something that I was looking toward. And now that I have, I mean, and like I said, it doesn't always happen, but I sleep much more than I did before, and I really feel a lot better because of it. So I am grateful that you came here today. And for those that have been listening, you know I end every episode playing what we call the Grateful Game. And it is just a taking a moment for all of us to think about what we're grateful for and why. Now, if you want to play this little game at home, at dinner, with family and friends, go for it. If you want to do it at night while you're cuddling in bed with your loved ones, go for it then. If it's the car, wherever it might be, I have found that in my wellness journey, in my healing journey, whatever it might, however we want to coin it, that having a mindful practice, and to me, I focus on gratitude, has been helpful when the days are tough to be able to, as I like to say, put one foot in front of the other. And so, Dr. Sarah, I want to ask you, what is something, anything, it could be the socks on your feet right now, because by the way, I had a little leg surgery a few weeks ago, and so I'm wearing compression socks, and these Comrade compression socks are awesome. They're cute and they're comfortable and they do the trick. So that could be something I say that I'm grateful for today. Or it could be like literally having a roof over your head in a day like today when it's pouring down rain, and really kind of any day. It could be big or small. So let us know, what is something that you are grateful for and why?
I love this game and this question so much, because showing our gratitude has also been shown to help improve our sleep quality. So it's pretty much on brand. But I would say, I have to say, I am so grateful for my doggie. Her name is Fancy. I usually work from home, and so she's my companion throughout the day, and I just love having her by my side. She truly is my fur daughter. So I just love having the companionship and having her by my side.
I love it. And I will say that love is new to me too, because I am only a dog owner of the last 3 years. The rest of my life, I never had animals. And to your point, it's just this love. You hear about it, unconditional love that a little furry friend can bring you up. And that's beautiful. So thank you for sharing that. And for you out there, wherever you may be, I hope you take a moment to think about gratitude and be mindful in that moment. Because like I said, hopefully it will bring a little bit of extra joy during whatever journey you're going through in life. And that's why we're here, because I'm hoping that something that we say in this podcast will help you find that happiness throughout the hardship, because we know life isn't always easy. And I'm wishing all of you great happiness and even better health. So thanks again, Dr. Sarah, for being here. Bye for now, everyone. One more thing. I would be so grateful if you'd take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. You leaving a review helps us with our podcast ranking. The higher we are ranked, the more people can discover our show. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sending you lots of happiness and great health.